This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention? Can you?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. Was that euphonious? Was that melodic? Were those tones dulcet? I'm a little punchy because I woke up crazy early, and not to do this, but I have to do this early. And it's been a crazy week. And I don't know if this will affect your listening experience, but I may have to stop this in the middle to go deal with some stuff. We have a pest control guy because we know we have a mouse living in the bowels of one of our oven, and I think I have something larger living in the wall of my basement office down here. It's going to be an adventure. Speaking of adventure, lots of stuff happened this week. I basically have a thing where if I have a speaking engagement on the Eastern Seaboard, I don't always drive. If I was speaking at a college in Maine, I probably wouldn't drive, you know, but like if it's six of one, half dozen of the other, when you add in all the travel and hassle of going to the train station or taking a short flight, I drive. And so it was sort of a no-brainer for me to drive up to Princeton earlier this week to do a talk for AI. AI has now these campus groups. It's a very, very, very small price to pay to be an AI scholar, to be of good cheer, to go do these talks when they ask you and when your schedule permits. And so whenever it's conceivable, I always say yes, and I'm happy to do it. And the kids are usually very, very impressive. And so anyway, I drove up to Princeton. I think that was Tuesday. I'll admit, because things have been so crazy, I didn't really study the agenda. It was like, have a conversation. And then I realized shortly before it was go time that they wanted me to talk about the history of fascism in America and abroad or something like that. And I was like, oh, okay. I haven't given a fascism talk in, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. And but that's fine. And then I get there and I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. These things definitely happen. It's happened before. It's happened to other people. The main kid who's the organizer of this is a former Dispatch intern. He's a smart, good guy with a nice future ahead of him. But it was abysmal. It was abysmal turnout. And I'm fairly ego-free about this kind of stuff. And, you know, when it's a normal campus speech, I've been to things where I've expected, you know, 18 people and gotten 80 or 500. And I've been to campus things where I expected, you know, 500 or 800 and gotten 50. turned out. It always depends on how these things are promoted, what else is going on campus, how many people from the nearby area want to go to these things. Like I recently did an event with Mara Eliason and at Bridgewater College. It's amazing how it was fairly packed room, but you know, it was like 80% grownups from the surrounding area and maybe 20% students. And that happens a lot. I remember when Steve Hayward had me out to when he was at University of Colorado Boulder, and he was the conservative chair guy, and he had me come out to speak, and it was great. It's packed room, you know, standing room only, but the number of students was, I don't know, I think like 30% of the students there were my nephews who happened to be going there. But anyway, it was just sort of like, this is, it is not worth these. And it was a longer drive than I expected. And there's some construction stuff. So it was like, this is just really not worth the 6.5 hour round trip to get to Princeton and back to talk to 10 kids. I mean, I'd rather have them just come to my house for dinner or something. And then the next night I did a talk at a paid event thing for a really great bunch of people. And I don't say that just because they paid me. I don't know what the protocols here are about identifying the groups for these kinds of things. But anyway, it was a International Financial Trade Association, I think I can say, because there's all this IMF stuff going on in DC. And so this, they were there for those meetings. And I'm supposed to go to the Willard Hotel, get there at 6. I had CNN from 4 to 5, which is fine, you know. So I guess it's the Willard Hotel, which, by the way, for people who don't know, Willard Hotel is lovely. One of my favorite bars is called the Round Bar in there. Maybe it's officially called the Round Robin Bar. I mean, it is full of a lot of, you know, lobbyists and kleptocrats and that kind of thing, but it's just a delightful space. But anyway, the lobby of the Willard, I believe, I should have double checked this, but I believe the Willard of the lobby is where the term lobbyist comes from. The story I've heard, and I apologize if I get getting this wrong, but the story I've heard more than once is Abraham Lincoln stayed there, as did a lot of presidents, before his inauguration. All the sort of favor seekers, hangers-on, what we today we would call lobbyists, were hanging out in the lobby of the Willard Hotel. And when Lincoln came downstairs and saw all these people saying, you know, Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Lincoln, or Mr. President, or whatever, it was someone get rid of all these damn lobbyists. And it stuck. And that's where the term comes from. I hope I'm remembering that right. And if I'm not, maybe I don't want to be corrected because it's just so good. So anyways, it's like a 11-minute drive, you know, from CNN to the Willard Hotel. I get there and there are concrete barriers for blocks around. There are cement trucks and garbage trucks. In DC, for those of you who don't live here, when they want to close off a road or a park or whatever, they basically use these, you know, like giant trucks, like cement trucks or garbage trucks, to block things off as sort of, you know, makeshift suicide bomber blockers. So the whole area around the Willard was like this. And there were guys with guns, I mean, serious guns, serious guys there. And so I ended up having to park like blocks away. And I was like, wow, this group I'm talking to is pretty important. And then I get in the lobby after going through the magnetometers, and I'm just sort of sitting there, dorking around, looking at my phone, because I got there early still. And then like this Iraqi dude in very serious, like full dress uniform sits down on the chair and right across from me. And then I look around and the place is just full of Middle Eastern military personnel. And it turns out that the security was there for, they were all in town for the IMF thing. And the security, I was told, was there because the president of Iraq was there. Also, like the Jordanian delegation and a bunch of other countries. And it was kind of freaky. And I guess the extra security, because this was above and beyond normal security, I guess the extra security was because there was just recently that thing where like the Jordanians and maybe the Iraqis, who knows, helped the Israelis defend themselves. But anyway, I don't know why. I'm just trying to warm up here. But I will say it was a great bunch of people. It was also really, I got to say, you know, I know I talk about this a lot, how like I always feel like I'm just putting a message in a bottle and throwing it out into the universe. And it always freaks me out when it turns out that people listen to this podcast, read the G-file and that kind of stuff. Because just the mental place I've been in for a quarter century when I do things like this is to feel like it's sort of like, you know, Radio Free Europe underground kind of thing, or just a message in a bottle and who knows if anybody's ever going to read it. And so it's always a little discomforting, but also really gratifying when I run into people who, you know, tell me how much Dispatch means to them or how much they like the Remnant or the G-File. And it was funny, the guy who at the speaking event thing I did, it was a conversation with me and the head of this group, who's a impressive guy with an impressive background. And he begins the conversation by saying, in front of all of these, you know, finance types, "So I listen to your Saturday morning podcast every morning. And the deal I've made with myself is I run until it's over. So I'm asking you here and now on the record, could you please make them a little shorter?" So I can't make those promises, because I, you know, when I start doing this thing, I kind of feel like I have no brakes, and I stop when I can find an uphill place that I can park my runaway truck of a mouth. But anyway, it was a nice event, and was glad to do it. And where to go from there? I guess I should talk about enough about me. So things are going great on the Hill. We talked about it a bunch on the Dispatch podcast. I got to say, I'm not alone on this. Mike Johnson is showing me something. I have been underwhelmed by him for a while, and purely my suspicion, and some conversations with people, but it's not like I've deeply reported this. It just kind of feels to me and to other people that like Johnson's realized that you can't keep being speaker defensively. Right. You can't keep signaling that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz can take bites out of you whenever they want to. And I know, I should say, I have a high degree of certainty that a lot of people have told, you know, Mike Johnson, who says, and I believe him, that he wants to help Ukraine. You know, he wants to provide aid for Ukraine. And they told him, look, If Ukraine loses, I mean, like straight up loses, and, you know, Zelensky is frog marched to some Siberian jail and eventually executed, or Russian troops control Kyiv, or even something, you know, short of that, where it's just Russia fully bites off half of Ukraine the way it's on path to doing, and it has to sort of surrender to it. Historians are going to look back and say one of the people most deserving of blame was the Speaker of the House, who prevented aid from getting to the floor when there were votes to pass it. And so I think Johnson has had this realization, or at least I like to think he's had this realization, that if he's going to lose his job over something, it should be over something that is worth it. And this would be worth it. Now, I still don't think he's going to lose his job. Everybody I talk to, you know, we'll say, yeah, there are a lot of Republicans who are mad at Johnson, but they don't hate him. Nobody could conceivably win a speakership vote wants the job. I should say wants the job right now, right? 6 months out or whatever we are from a presidential election with Trump bigfooting everything and a one vote or one or two seat majority for Republicans. That is the kind of poison chalice that even people like Scalise or whoever who want to be speaker, they're like, yeah, I'll wait until conditions are better. So nobody qualified wants it now. And none of the unqualified people, and I'm grading on a curve about qualified and unqualified here. None of the unqualified people could win a speakership vote to get it. And so the proposition is, do you want one of these chaotic, paralyzed House of Representatives situations with round and round of votes that fail, that make the Republicans look ridiculous going into an election year? Does the Trump campaign want that? the thinking is that like Trump will pull the leash on people like Gates and Massey and Green enough to keep them from toppling Johnson. But that's not by any means assured, and it could get much uglier over the weekend before things settle out. But I watched from CNN. I was supposed to go back on TV to comment about it, but the interview went long, and I don't blame them for sticking with the interview, because Jake Tapper did a really good job talking to Mike Johnson about all this stuff. And I got to say, Mike Johnson was impressive. He really showed some chops, and he said things that, like, been waiting for a long time for someone in Republican leadership to say about America's role in the world, about how he's a Reagan Republican, and also talking to the public like they're grownups, including talking to his own caucus and talking to Republican voters like they're grownups, and explaining why he's doing this the way he is, explaining why he can't do everything that he wants or that the base wants, because they don't have the vote. If you want your heart's desires in politics, you got to win more elections. And, you know, all the stuff that I, you know, been talking about for a while, you know. So, of course, when Johnson starts saying things that I have been believing for a long time, I think he's brilliant. No, but it was more adept. It was more forceful. It was more manful. It was more resolved, or resolute, I should say, than I've come to expect from him. And look, I don't think it surprises anybody. I have such contempt for, you know, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I really think is just an awful person. I don't see anything redeeming about her whatsoever. I think she's dumb. I think she's easily misled. I think she's a nasty person. I think she's incredibly callous about Ukraine. If that is your enemy inside the Republican caucus, you've already earned, put a couple points on the board with me. And then, of course, there's Matt Gaetz, right? Matt Gaetz, I saw him in an interview, I think it was yesterday, talking about how, well, I had hoped deposing Kevin McCarthy was, you know, that was all we needed. We only needed one dose or one treatment. But, you know, there are some conditions where you need more than one dose or one treatment to cure the illness. And so we may have to do it again. You know, it's this extended medical metaphor about having to vacate the chair again because the first round of treatments didn't work. And just coming from Matt Gaetz, all I can think about is, well, of course he's talking like this, because who knows how many rounds of antibiotics he's gone through for his various cases of gonorrhea. I just find, you know, these people to be so execrable and dishonorable, and their arguments are so pathetic. I mean, this idea, this claim, this suggestion that it is outrageous for a speaker to do anything with Democratic votes, a Republican speaker to do anything with Democratic votes, this is a brand new idea in the history of the United States, as far as I can tell. And I'm open. I got friends who are much better historians of congressional stuff. So, like, it's entirely possible there is something of a parallel in, like, the 1850s with, you know, slavery issues going on. But I don't think so. It's been an idea for a long time that the speaker from a specific party should be able to move legislation with a majority of his own party behind it, right? I mean, like, it would be weird if you had a Republican speaker constantly moving legislation that more Democrats voted for than Republicans. I'm sure that kind of thing has happened in the past, but it'd be weird, and it would be weird if it happened regularly. You know, and then you had, you know, 15 years ago, you know, the development of this thing called the Hastert rule, which, again, any guy who's sent to prison for fairly gross things, you should probably come up with a new name for the rule that you still use. But the Hastert rule was basically like, you shouldn't bring in, I think it's to the floor, right? You shouldn't bring anything to the floor that didn't have at least majority support of the Republican caucus, which I get. I think there's an argument for it. I can see where it came from. I think this kind of stuff, I think the problem with that rule was that it led to, it didn't end there. The logic of it just kept going. And so now the argument, you know, from people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and others is that it is outrageous to get a piece of legislation, say the Ukraine support bill, say the Israel thing, right? I mean, because Marjorie Taylor Greene has talked out of both sides of her mouth about the Israel stuff. To get any piece of legislation through, it is outrageous if it doesn't have unanimous support from Republicans. And that argument is basically, you know, there's this House Freedom Caucus fringe, which, I mean, look, the people who don't like the Ukraine stuff is much larger than the number of people who are in favor of wanting to vacate the chair. But it's the people who want to vacate the chair, right? So when they did it with, which basically just means fire the speaker. When they did it with Kevin McCarthy, it was, I think, 8 Republicans pushing it, led by Matt Gaetz, that ousted Kevin McCarthy. 96% of the Republican caucus didn't want that. The idea that somehow that dynamic should work on legislation as well is just so profoundly stupid, right? The idea that a Republican speaker should lose his job by moving legislation to the floor that is supported by, I shouldn't say, again, it's not supported by his, the support, I'd say it's about 50-50, 60-40, something like that for the Ukraine stuff in the caucus. I got to check the math on that. I know the House Freedom Caucus put out a statement saying that they're against all of it. Although a lot of them aren't against it on the merits. A lot of them say they're against it because it's not tied to border security. But regardless, the idea that you couldn't move a piece of legislation that got majority support from Republicans, that but passed because it also got majority support from Democrats, that that's somehow a betrayal of the Republican Party, is just sand-poundingly stupid. And the idea behind it is just essentially that the tail gets to wag the dog on all operations of the House. And Johnson can't stay speaker like that. No one could. And so you got to stand up to it at some point. And I think he's doing the right thing by standing up to it.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
What else happened this week? I've studiously avoided talking about the Mayorkas stuff as much as possible. And I did talk about it on CNN this week. So, you know, I revisited my priors and thought about what I think about it because, you know, I was there for the live breaking coverage of the Mayorkas impeachment, which the whole process lasted, I don't know, a few hours because they dismissed it all. So I never particularly liked the idea of impeaching Mayorkas, but I never really opposed it very much either. Serious people say he did lie to Congress. I've seen arguments going both ways about that. The other argument, the other bill of impeachment, I thought was kind of weak sauce. But again, I know it annoys people, but my both sidesism is kicking in. I think Biden should have fired Mayorkas a long time ago. And let me put it this way, whether or not he was doing a good job, right? I think for the sake of Biden's own political prospects, but also for the sake of restoring confidence in the Biden administration or the government's, you know, the government generally when it comes to dealing with border security, he just should have said, you know, 6 months, a year ago, I've lost confidence in this guy and, you know, we're going to put in so-and-so and we're going to start fresh. And I also think Mayorkas should have resigned a year ago. I think he should have said, you know, I stand by what I did, and I stand by the people of my agency who are doing tireless, thankless work, and I appreciate, you know, the president for giving me this opportunity, but I've clearly become a distraction. You know, I mean, part of my argument is just a sister soldier kind of argument, and you should go read Nick Kotogia's newsletter about, you know, the limits of Biden's ability to do sister soldier stuff. But one of the, and I agree with most of it, but at the same time, I think one of the reasons why it's become increasingly difficult for Biden to do sister soldier stuff, because he hasn't done any yet. And so it puts more drama and significance and makes it seem more cynical if he waits, in a way, if he waits this long to do it. Like, why now, other than you're freaking out about losing the election, did you actually decide to, you know, throw Jamal Bowman or Mayorkas or whoever under the bus to send a signal? But like, I just have contempt for everybody in this thing. I think the symbolism of impeaching Mayorkas is just red meat fodder for Fox News audiences and talk radio, and it would not have done anything to fix the border. I think it was a huge waste of time. But at the same time, like, the Republican frustration, popular frustration with how Biden has screwed up handling the border is fair and legitimate. And so, like, using it as a symbol, I get the politics of it. And I have such contempt for Biden for not actually, like, being able to read the room and govern the way he implied that he was going to govern. And, you know, look, if this had been, if Bill Clinton had been president during all this kind of stuff, the Oval Office would be, you know, plastered with plastic sheeting all over the place to deal with all of the blood, viscera, and gore from all of the scapegoats he sacrificed for his own political self-interest. And you can, you know, you can decry that, you can talk about how it's dishonorable and all that kind of stuff. But some of that stuff is just politics. It's like the symbolism of what fights you pick, who you fire, who you hire. These things matter in politics. And Biden just seems checked out from all of this. And that's why this Mayorkas thing festered, as stupid as I think a lot of it was, into what it became. And the fact that the Senate dismissed it, you know, out of hand is probably good for both parties, but bad for the country and bad for the issue, because it just, like, I think Mitt Romney's position was the right one. Let's at least hear a debate about it for a little while, and then we can decide. But let's not just, like, sort of throw this out without even hearing the arguments. It fuels frustration for Republicans who have a very legitimate gripe about the border stuff and about immigration generally. And it fuels smugness and self-satisfaction for Democrats who need to run saying we give no quarter to Republicans, nothing they do is legitimate. And those two mindsets screw everything else up in our politics often. Not every day, but often. So briefly, you know, so last night, I'm recording this very early, Friday morning. Last night, Israel struck back at Iran. We really don't know much more than that. It sounds like a very surgical, specific, discreet strike. It was not like some massive bombing campaign. I suspect that it's a very, very symbolic thing where it just basically, Israel is saying, our missiles can get through. We know where your nuclear program is, and we're going to blow up this stuff. And if you attack us on our soil again, we all understand what that's going to look like. And if that's it, okay, I'm fine with that. You know, if everybody goes back to their corners for a little while on this and things calm down in the region and we don't have a broader regional war, I knowing as little as I know right now about what happened and, you know, all the rest, I'm willing to not gainsay what the Israelis did here. And we'll just see. I talked with Eli Lake for a long time about it. We talked a bit on the Dispatch podcast as well. I do not like the way Biden handles this issue. I do not think it is smart. I can handle cold-blooded, hard-hearted realism and cynicism if it was to back up a smart strategy, but I just don't see any evidence of that. And again, we do not have a lot of visibility into all the stuff that's going on behind the scenes, but at the public diplomacy, rhetorical, strategic level, I think Biden looks pretty hapless here in that his only desire is for everybody to keep it down so he can try and win an election and not piss off anti-Israel people and not piss off pro-Israel people too much. And I think it's not, that's kind of, at least it's logically untenable. Maybe it's politically feasible, but I don't think it's driving the best policies or the best approach or the best positions or the best rhetoric or anything like that. I will say, I think nature is healing on a couple different fronts. First of all, thought it was a really good sign that at Pomona, they were like, yeah, no, we're not doing this. And just basically gave the pro-Hamas or pro-Palestinian. I think that we can talk about that in a second. I think that distinction is blurring really rapidly. It was like, you got 10 minutes to get out of here. We're calling the cops, and they kicked them all out. And then we saw something similar yesterday at Columbia. I am all in favor of it. I think you have to follow the rules. You have to get permission to do the kind of protest that you're planning on doing. You can't say heinous, grotesque things. Yeah, I get this free speech stuff, but like, there's also, we're not going to do that argument again. There's also just sort of like honor code, decency kind of thing. You know, we also saw in Bakersfield, California, the idiotic activist woman who I love it. She was complaining about a proposal by the Bakersfield like city council about adding more security to the building or something like that. And she goes on this tear about how outrageous this is, that you're militarizing the city council and spending time and money on this when you should be, you know, doing something productive, like demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. Because, you know, everyone would just drop their guns and go home once news that the Bakersfield, California City Council called for a ceasefire. I mean, that would do the trick. But anyway, she's yammering on about this. And then she just says, and besides, you know, just because you have metal detectors here, that won't save you because we know where you live and we'll go to your houses and murder you. And the city council was like, yeah, whoa, not odd. You can't threaten to murder us. And she was arrested and she was crying and all this stuff. And good. You know, like the permission, the permissiveness of our culture these days to allow dumbassery and that veers into actual physical and violence, it's just got to kind of come to stop. That's what I mean by nature is healing. And then we saw at Google, like 28 morons occupied offices at Google and staged like a sit-in protest and chanted stupid things and screamed stupid things. And Google's like, yeah, you're all fired. You're just so fired. I'm delighted by this. You know, I hope everybody who was involved is fired and these aren't just like the worst offenders. Because look, you have no right to stage a protest at your workplace without permission, shutting down the proper functioning of your business. Well, you have a right to do it, right? But you also have a right to face the you also have to face the consequences. And that could mean being arrested. It could mean getting fired. And, you know, I hate to sound like Tony Soprano, but there have to be consequences. I'm all for letting people, as long as they're not violent, do things that they think are consistent with their conscience. So, like, by all means, these idiot protesters, And I think they're idiots because I think it's just terrible strategy and tactics, and they're morally wrong on the substance and whatever. But I'm perfectly comfortable defending the charge of idiot. Not in the original Greek sense of the word idiot, which just simply meant a citizen who didn't care to be informed about politics. I mean, in the modern, like, drooling, too stupid to be a spell checker at an M&M factory, dumb person sense of idiot. But anyway, like, by all means, shut down the Golden Gate Bridge, shut down the Brooklyn Bridge, right? Stop normal citizens from being able to get to the airport, but then don't bitch and moan when you get arrested. And you should be arrested really damn quickly, like almost instantaneously. But if you want to make the statement, you are free to, civil disobedience, right? You know, you're free to make any statement that you want, but you have to face the consequences. And sometimes the consequences are losing your job or going to jail. And it is appalling to me. The Washington Post just did this thing where they did these sympathetic profiles. You know, so there's this Twitter account, I'm sure it's on other platforms as well, called Stop Antisemitism. And, you know, immediately after or shortly after October 7, those posters of kidnapped kids and other people went up around all these cities, right? The Stop Antisemitism account is the one that was primarily in the business of posting videos of these people tearing down these posters. And they did it unapologetically. They knew they were being recorded. Sometimes they talk smack to the camera and all that kind of thing. And some of these people have faced consequences. And this has made the Washington Post, which has been abysmal in its coverage of Israel, I mean, just, I think, shamefully bad. They did this sympathetic profile of these poor people who have run into, you know, problems because they've been seen on video tearing down posters of kidnapped children, most of whom are almost surely dead if they haven't been released already, talking about how cruel and vicious it is to expose these people. Well, look, these people are doing this in public. These posters are in public. These people were doing it unapologetically. And what they were actually doing was grotesque. If you think that, like, it is somehow unfair to Hamas or to the Palestinians to put posters up identifying hostages, many of whom were probably raped to death, but we didn't know that then. If you think that, like, that's the outrage, if that's what really offends you, is this idea of trying to garner sympathy for Israelis or for hostages, so much so that you can't just walk by a poster, you have to tear it down, and then you're going to bitch and moan about how unfair it is for people to actually know that you did that. And then the Washington Post is going to sort of put that on blast to make that case. I just think I have contempt for so much of it. Oh, yeah, just on the nature's healing thing, I do think people are realizing that there have to be limits, there have to be consequences. I suspect, you know, maybe it's a good G-file to do about how nature's healing on a bunch of places and a bunch of fronts, because I know I can be a kind of downer and everyone wants to focus on the negative, but there are a lot of good things that are going on in the universe. I don't know about the universe. Things could be really bad around Alpha Centauri, but like on Earth in America, there's a lot of good stuff happening. Anyway, every now and then I just do like a cheer up, things aren't that bad kind of thing. Maybe I'm due to do another one. On the nature's healing thing, you know, I think people are just realizing, like, You got to just start drawing lines. You know, you can't do this constant give a mouse a cookie stuff with people who are just openly celebrating. And it, like, I got to talk about this on the Chris Wallace show this weekend. You know, we got the show notes about what the topics are. And there, you know, there's this topic about, you know, where does being anti-war or anti-Israel cross the line into anti-Semitism, which is, you know, a perfectly legitimate thing to talk about. Lots of people talked about it for a very long time. I get it and all that kind of stuff. But I've been thinking about it, and it's just like, I think the anti-Semitism thing, which is real and terrible, you know, I mean, as Sarah Isger often points out, you know, it's not a coincidence that these really gross protesters camp out outside of the homes of Jewish administration of people. You know, like, it's not, you know, shocking that it's not a coincidence that Jewish professors are and Jewish businesses are attacked, which is the logic of collective guilt, right? I mean, you can't, it is anti-Semitic. It is certainly anti-Semitic. I don't want to go through my whole structural anti-Semitism argument again, but like, if you just take the logic of how people talk about, say, systemic racism or institutional racism, there's a lot of systemic anti-Semitism out there, according to the left's understanding of how this system, right? So like, I'll do it, right? Just because I can't remember what I was about to talk about. So the reason why we get the concepts of institutional racism or critical race theory or all that stuff emerges in the 80s and 90s. And obviously it has intellectual antecedents going back, but I'm doing a shorthand here. It emerges in the 80s and 90s to deal with the problem that they couldn't find very much deliberate, intentional racism anymore. They couldn't find it among bureaucrats, among policymakers, among employers. The various civil rights laws and trial lawyers and activist groups had rooted this kind of stuff out. Yeah, you would get small examples of it here or there, but all the low-hanging fruit had gone away, and yet you still had disparate outcomes for racial groups. And for women, right? So like you can do the exact same process, same argument about, you know, critical feminist theory, right? Which was definitely a thing. That was a big chunk of my college education. And so the argument emerged. It's kind of brilliant, right? It's very much the Ibram Kendi argument. The argument emerged that you don't have to look at intent anymore. You have to look at the structures of power, you know, very Foucauldian, the structures of power, the legacy of institutional racism, so that even though no one today, no one alive, no one in power now is consciously doing racist things, they're perpetuating racist systems that have been left over from the past. And, you know, so like, and some of the arguments had merit, you know, and I've said this a million times, you know, like, when it comes to things like infrastructure, a lot of like sewage treatment plants were put in parts of town that were disproportionately black and poor, because black and poor people didn't have a lot of political power, and people with political power didn't want giant sewage treatment plants near their houses. I just use it as an example about how, you know, there's some merit to this stuff. But more broadly, this argument, which has now emerged, which just simply says that discrepancies in group performances of any kind, or discrepancies in treatment of groups in any kind, if it is to the detriment in any way of historically discriminated against groups, which is another construction they had to come up with because Asians started doing well, and so you just couldn't do it of non-whites, right? If there's any disparity, any discrepancy, any disparate outcome or effects, whatever, that deleteriously, that reflects poorly in any way on or impacts in any negative way certain recognized groups, then you don't need to go find intent. That's the argument. And it's the argument that, you know, suffuses a lot of the equal pay stuff for women, where they don't want to look deep into like the numbers. They just like the end, the last page, the last chart in the presentation just says, look, here's this discrepancy at the macro level. And therefore, that's proof of sexism, right? And you can do the same thing with college admissions, SAC scores, you know, wealth gaps, income gaps, all these kinds of things, right? Well, if that's how that argument works, then the United Nations, for starters, this is where I originally wrote about this, then the United Nations is structurally anti-Semitic because it has a glaring double standard when it comes to Israel. Israel gets condemned more than any other country by orders of magnitude. It is singled out as a human rights abuser, I think unfairly, for the most part, than any other country. And you go down a very long list, right? And it is singled out in a way that even if you don't want to accuse individual nations or individual delegates or bureaucrats of being anti-Semitic, the disparate results by the left's logic, if they applied to any other entity, to a black institution, a gay institution, women, whatever, everyone would say, obviously, this is structural discrimination. This is systemic bias. Well, the UN has systemic bias, but so do a lot of these universities, because they just have different rules about how to treat anti-Semitic speech versus every other kind of bigoted speech. And you don't have to get deep in the weeds about whether or not these individual protesters do in fact hate Jews, though I think a good number of them do. By the rules that these schools live by, all of this stuff is anti-Semitic because of its disproportionality. But again, I think the anti-Semitism debate is kind of a distraction for as important as I think it is. It's a distraction in a sense because there's this other stuff to think about. I mean, at some of these protests in the last week, you had people waving Hezbollah flag. You have people openly, you know, you have, you know, Cornel West talking about how the October 7th Hamas attack was a counter-terrorist strike. Well, screw that guy. I mean, I know I have friends who like the guy. I hear he's charming in person. I believe that. But he's pro-terrorist. And forget whether it's anti-Semitic terrorism, which obviously it is, when you say you want to eliminate the Jewish state, when you want to, you know, purge the Jews from the river to the sea. And, you know, I mean, the Houthis, literally their official slogan ends with something like, and death to the Jews. These are anti-Semitic groups. The fact that, yes, it's bad that all of these people are defending rabid, genocidal anti-Semites, but it's also bad that they're supporting genocidal terrorists. You know, if you protest immediately after Israel is defended from an attack by Iran, and it pisses you off that not enough Jews died, you're just pro-Iran, right? Which is a terrorist state. Hamas, by any definition of terrorism that any serious person has ever put on paper in the last 200 years, is quintessentially a terrorist organization. The people who say, you know, basically it's a binary choice, either have to support Israel or have to support Hamas, and they choose Hamas, they're just flatly supporting terrorism. And then the gaslighting begins about how, you know, the Zionists are the real terrorists. I don't like fifth column talk, you know, but there are people openly shouting into megaphones across this country, siding with and lending aid and support rhetorically, and who knows if otherwise, for straight, flat out Hollywood villain terrorist organizations. I know that it's a more interesting conversation, and a lot of Jews who are invested in the problem of anti-Semitism are more comfortable talking about the problem of anti-Semitism. But like, for just plain old-fashioned American policymakers, right, about what the actual anti-Semitism is bad. But if you are in an office at the NSA or the Pentagon or the CIA, you have someone come in and says, okay, we got two problems. There's a huge outbreak of anti-Semitic feeling in America, and there's a huge outbreak of people openly supporting terror organizations that have killed countless Americans over the years. You can decry the anti-Semitism stuff, but you might want to focus on the people who are openly supporting terrorist organizations. And so, you know, we got into this thing with Eli Lake the other day about, you know, whether the FBI was at January 6th. And I have my disagreements with some of the stuff about that. But like, he's right that to some extent, the FBI should be at those crowds at January 6th when you've got members of sort of paramilitary militias showing up in Washington, you know, good to keep an eye on them, whatever. I hope the FBI is writing down names of these people who are openly supporting Hamas, who are asking for donations to go to organizations that money launder essentially for Hamas or Hezbollah. I hope the people who are chanting, you know, keep your hands off the Houthis or keep your hands off Yemen, which they mean the part that is occupied by this terrorist militia group called the Houthis. I hope the FBI knows who they are. And not because I want to weaponize our justice system or our government against my political enemies or any of that kind of crap. I just think that if you're out there waving a pom-pom and cheering on internationally recognized terrorist organizations, America should know who you are. I mean, the people responsible for thwarting terrorism on American soil or against American interests and allies, they should know who you are. You should be in the database. I don't say that to intimidate anybody. I mean, it'd be nice if some of these people were intimidated by the idea that they would face consequences for being pro-murder. I say it because I just think it's something that it's a responsibility of the government to stay on top of this kind of thing. Anyway, all right, done with all that.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time. No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
A bunch of people have asked me what I thought about this thing going on with the National Conservative Conference in Brussels, where the government there tried to shut it down. I think eventually they found a venue and the mayor overruled it or something like that. I haven't followed it too closely. I think it's funny, right? I think it's dumb. I think by all means, let these guys have their meeting. Like, I don't know what, I don't want to get over my skis about, with conjecture about the sorts of Belgians who attend a NatCon conference. Some of them may be unsavory. I don't think it's a bunch of neo-Nazis or anything like that, though. I mean, Yoram Hazony is, I have my profound disagreements with the dude, but he's a yarmulke-wearing Israeli, and he's the head of this organization. And so, I have my major disagreements with the guy, but, like, I don't think he's a bad person, and I don't think he's so committed to this nationalism stuff that he would want to form a common alliance with neo-Nazis or Islamists or anything like that. And so the idea of shutting down that conference on security grounds, I just think is really incredibly stupid and unfair. Okay. That said, the thing I think is funny about it is, like, all of these post-liberal types who think that, you know, procedural liberalism is what is destroying the virility and the survival of the manful nation state, they kind of have to, like, deal with the fact that there are people in their ranks who would have no problem shutting down a globalist conference if they were in charge somewhere. I don't want to do Man for All Seasons stuff, but it is this amazing thing about how illiberal people sometimes are the loudest whiners when they face illiberalism towards them. I mean, the number of nationalists and post-liberal this, whatever, people who bitch and moan about free speech on Twitter or elsewhere and being shadow banned and all this kind of stuff is amazing, given that they're not actually all that committed to free speech in theory. I mean, look, I mean, if you think that you're this major opponent, this consistent and profound intellectual and philosophical opponent of classical liberalism, of Lockeanism, right, or Mills and, you know, whatever, and you go around crapping on classical liberalism as a desiccated and dying faith that has led Western civilization asunder, but you're actually committed to free speech and freedom of assembly and all that kind of stuff, then you got to work out your math better. I mean, there's a glitch in your argument, unless the argument is, and which is often the case for illiberal groups. I'm not necessarily saying the NatCons in particular, but, like, you know, illiberal groups often use the rules of liberalism or rules of democracy to get power, and then they pull up the gangplank behind them and they shut all that stuff down. I don't think that's, I mean, I know that there are illiberal people on the left and the right that would do that, but I think a lot of the people who bitch and moan and rend their cloth and gnash their teeth about being censored or shadow banned and all that kind of stuff are sincere. And I just think they're also just inconsistent, because the whole point of liberal rules is that the rules apply to everybody. I want to be clear. I don't actually literally mean everybody in the sense that, well, I shouldn't, I don't know. Like, look, I think just to give an extreme example to illustrate why I hesitated there, I don't think child pornographers have any First Amendment rights to put out child pornography. Or, if you want to phrase it differently, because sometimes this is a really, it's a linguistic distinction for some people that's very, very important. I think the rights of the state, community, the citizenry, the voters, however you want to put it, trump the free speech rights to put out child pornography, right? And so there are reasonable places where you can curtail free speech rights because of greater concerns. And, you know, we're having this debate now on a much more mainstream topic, which is, you know, TikTok or smartphones for kids. And people, I think, know where I come down on all this stuff. I think you can make reasonable distinctions while still protecting First Amendment stuff. But the people who bitch and moan about, you know, being censored, who are also saying that liberalism stinks and they want to replace it with something else, they just, you know, they need to work on their arguments a little bit more. Let the NatCon speak. I got no problem with that. By the way, let this girl, this valedictorian girl, speak at USC. I think her views on Israel stink and are, I think, are certainly, as I was saying earlier, they are structurally anti-Semitic. But I think USC is being cowardly by blaming it all on security concerns. I would have much less of a problem if their position was, we need to look and see what she's going to say. And if she's going to be using valuable time at graduation to go on a stem winder about how Israel needs to be Jew free from the river to the sea, then we're not going to let her speak, because that's an inappropriate thing to talk about at a time of celebration, you know, which is graduation. I have no problem with prior restraint and content editorial, you know, editorial management of valedictory addresses or graduation speeches at universities. It just doesn't bother me at all to say, look, this is an event for everybody. This is not a platform for you to maximally invoke your First Amendment rights to talk about whatever you want. This event is not about you. It's about the entire community. It's about all the seniors. And so if you want to say, you know, talk about something that's unifying and upbeat, vanilla-ish, by all means, go ahead and do it. But this is not the place for you to, you know, vent a spleen about something that is going to mar the day's events. And if that bothers some of my, you know, First Amendment absolutists, I'm happy to have that conversation. But what USC has done is just basically say, oh, we're scared of controversy. She has said bad things or controversial things about Israel in the past, so we're rescinding our invitation. And I think that's scummy and a bad idea, and it's turning her into a martyr. They could have handled it better, but a lot of these schools, I mean, nature's healing, but a lot of these schools are pretty cowardly. What else? So I have this idea in my head. I've been putting off talking about it on here today because I figured once I got started, I would not stop. I have this idea for a G-file. I don't know if I'm going to have the time to do it, but I think it's this really aha moment kind of thing for me. I was reading about this study put up by Harvard social psychologists about the prevalence of zero-sum thinking and how it and the distribution of zero-sum thinking and how it informs our politics. And it's very interesting to me. It dovetails with a lot of themes and things I've been talking about around here for a long time. And I think it gets at something kind of fundamental that I've been noodling for a while. And so, I'm an hour into this. I can't, you know, the pest control guy is going to be here any minute. So I can't get into the weeds on it. But if I don't write it, the G-file today, look for it coming soon. But just to be, not to make it too much of a sort of shaggy dog tease, I think most people know what zero-sum thinking means. They certainly know what it is in real life, even if they don't know, you know, how to use the term necessarily in every context. But, you know, the zero-sum fallacy in economics is the idea that economic exchange there's a winner and a loser, right? Zero sum. I mean, it works on the assumption that there's a static amount of wealth and or resources. And so if you get a cheeseburger that denies somebody else a cheeseburger, and there are situations where that's true, right? If you are staying late at the office and you have five people working there and the delivery guy from DoorDash or whatever only delivers four of your cheeseburgers that you ordered. If one person gets a cheeseburger, that means somebody else isn't. And those events, those kinds of situations happen in life. But that mindset doesn't actually apply to market economics. Because if you go to a diner and you're hungry and you want a cheeseburger, you buy a cheeseburger. The person who's selling you the cheeseburger is happy to take your money. They like money. And you are getting a cheeseburger, which is what you wanted. That's why you gave them money. That's win-win. Like, there's no loser there. And if enough people go in to buy cheeseburgers from the place, odds are good that the price of cheeseburgers will go down, which is fine because at volume, the cheeseburger guy can make more money. And with volume comes lower prices, which means that more people who are hungry can spend less money to get the cheeseburgers that they want. And if he hikes the prices, you know, price cheeseburger price gouging, a competitor down the street will start selling cheeseburgers. And so competition actually is good. It is not bad. This is something that took a lot of people a lot of time in the 18th and 19th century to understand. The pie grows. If someone becomes a billionaire, that doesn't make you a pauper. Yes, wealth is distributed unevenly throughout a society, but that doesn't mean that poor people don't benefit when everyone else gets rich. You know, the complaints about income inequality and wealth inequality do not work unless you have a subjective definition of these things. Unless your complaint is that the amount of money that the person at the bottom has is unfair because it's the percentage versus the ratio between rich people and poor people is unfair, right? But if you have an objective definition of poverty, about how many calories you can eat, how many square feet you live in, whether you have indoor plumbing, you know, go down a long list of like material things, you cannot make the argument that the poor have gotten poorer. You can make an argument that the poor have gotten poorer relative to how much poorer they are as a ratio of really rich people. But if poor people are getting richer and rich people are getting richer, that's a different thing than the way this stuff is generally talked about. In the 18th century, in the 19th century, people like Karl Marx, you know, he had this labor theory of value, which basically said that all economic exchange is exploitative and that working for a wage meant that like all the value in a product was from the hands that made the product. And so the owner of the factory was vampirically stealing value from the labor of the worker. And that's why capitalism was bad. It was exploitative from bottom to top and all that kind of stuff. And the people who made these kinds of arguments, I have had this idea for a while because I was reading, you know, I read this Christopher Clark book about the revolutions of 1848, and he gets into this really fascinating stuff about the explosion of the statistical analysis in the 1830s and 1840s that gave all of these new social scientists and sociologists, these are all 19th century terms, it gave them this ability, they thought, to see all of society sort of omnisciently. Like they thought like it gave them a God's eye view of how society actually works. And I think I've had this view for a while now that like this is in a lot of ways where a lot of the intellectuals started to believe that God was dead. And I can't get into too deep in the weeds on that, but I know it's attributed to Nietzsche. And I think he says that in the Gay Science in the 1880s or something like that. But the point is that this thing in socialism, progressivism, statism, you know, whatever you want to call it, but also in big chunks of nationalism, is this idea that you look at the society as a complete whole. And since the divine right of kings is really sort of no longer legitimate in people's minds, and we are now masters of our own fate, and we know how to like manipulate economic variables, the argument for political equality should also apply for the argument for economic equality. And so everyone should have the same amount of wealth. And I don't think that view could exist unless, I don't think that view is sustainable for very long unless you have a static zero-sum view of economics. Because let's just say there's a finite amount of wealth in a society and you see a whole bunch of people getting rich, well, then obviously they're taking wealth from other people. And all the arguments about social leveling, you know, from Babeuf, who was an 18th century guy and one of the French revolutionaries and the terror bad guy, straight through to the early 20th century, the arguments against economic aristocracies was that, you know, they didn't deserve, you know, the new ruling classes were no more deserving of their status and power and wealth as the old ruling classes who got it from, you know, basically being the descendants of warlords. And now that experts had this ability to look at the numbers and the sort of the cellular data of the body politic, we should give these experts the ability to figure out how to reorganize society from scratch, where you don't have these inequities, these disparities, where you don't have these undeserving rich, this new aristocracy of wealth. And those ideas, again, from Babeuf through Saint-Simon, through Marx and Comte, all the way through the progressives of the early 20th century, rests at some metaphysical level on this idea that wealth distribution is zero sum. Anyway, that's not the new thing that I'm sort of jazzed about. The study about zero sum mindset, the zero sum mindset, looks at stuff other than economics. Like, I've written a lot about zero sum economic stuff over the last 30 years. Lots of people have written about it. Like, I'm sure every libertarian adjacent free market egghead site out there, from our friends at the Acton Institute or the American Institute for Economic Research or von Mises crowd, I'm sure there are dozens of op-eds about the zero-sum fallacy, you know, and lots of stuff written smarter than me by Thomas Sowell and all that kind of stuff. What's interesting is, to me, and which has sort of gotten me my juices going in my cabeza, how it explains our politics in areas outside of economics. So the study says that Democrats are slightly more zero-sum than have a slightly more zero-sum mindset than Republicans do when it comes to economics, which makes sense, right? I mean, the whole point of having the government redistribute wealth through entitlements, through poverty stuff, and all that kind of stuff, that's why a lot of people are Democrats, is if you believe that, right? And I think the causality can go both ways. You can be for economic redistribution because you have a zero-sum mindset, or you can develop a zero-sum mindset because you believe that you're convinced by the ideology of, or the philosophy, whatever, of your party, right? But they point out there's a lot of zero-sum mindset people in the Republican Party as well. And actually what is interesting isn't that it illuminates the differences between Republicans and Democrats, is that it illuminates the differences between different factions within both parties. And so I'll give you an example of the zero-sum mindset in something that isn't about economic redistribution. Immigration. People who believe that there is, I mean, they may not think it in their head consciously, right? But people who believe at some gut level that there are a finite number of jobs. And so when immigrants come here and quote unquote take jobs from Americans, that's a zero sum thing, right? It's like, it's one group coming in, taking a finite resource from another group. There are people on the left who believe this, and there are people on the right who believe this in various ways. There's a very high level of zero sum mindset among African Americans, which shouldn't shock anybody. One of the things they get into in the study is how a lot of this is historically determined or influenced. You know, if you're, forget race, if you're just a member of the non-college working class, it is not unreasonable for you to think, and you live in some town where all of a sudden immigrants are coming in and they're taking a bunch of jobs, and now those municipal jobs, which are kind of finite, are going to these people instead of you and your people. That feels very zero-sum-y. And so the point is like, the zero-sum mindset is wrong when it's applied to market economics broadly. But that does not mean there aren't zero-sum situations, right? That doesn't mean where, you know, like the whole binary choice thing is a zero-sum thing. Only one person can win the contest for the presidency. So if Biden wins, Trump loses. If Trump wins, Biden loses. For the people who really care about one or the other winning, it's a zero-sum thing. And that's why they shout binary choice at me 100 times a week. And they're right. given their priors, right? Given their commitments, it is a binary choice and it is zero sum. But what's interesting to me about this is that the zero sum mindset influences how people see the culture war, right? I've been using that. I mean, the drawing is right there on the wall next to me with the two dogs, you know, in suits, having drinks at the bar. And one dog says to the other, "It's not enough that we succeed. Cats must also fail." You've heard me say that a million times, right? That is the dynamic of the culture war, right? And so there are these people, lots of them, who think a win for Democrats on something is a loss for Republicans. Full stop. That's Marjorie Taylor Greene's position about this idiotic, you know, House stuff, is that she thinks if you do something that Democrats like, that means you're doing something wrong from a Republican perspective. The idea that maybe Democrats like some things that are good for the country too, or are the right policy too, doesn't seem to enter the equation in this. And tribalism is very zero sum, right? Tribalism says cats must also fail. Tribalism says if it's good for my tribe, it's bad for the other tribe. If it's good for the other tribe, it's bad for my tribe. I mean, this is another way, and I know I talk about catastrophizing and stuff. It is another way to explain and illuminate why so many people are sort of in these ideological bunkers or silos, cannot conceive of doing things that might be for the betterment of the country, or just simply might be good policy if it turns out that the other side agrees with it, right? I mean, the way, if you listen to Fox News, if you listen to MSNBC, you get these people on all the time who think any win for Donald Trump is a loss for the country. Well, some of Trump's legal wins are a win for the country, not because they're good for Trump. I'm not rooting for Trump in any of this, but because they're upholding our system of laws and the rules, even for Donald Trump. And meanwhile, there are lots of people who think anything that is good for Biden is bad for the country. Well, no. I mean, take this friggin' Ukraine stuff. You know, yeah, Biden's a Democrat. He's also the president of the United States. And he said publicly that we are going to back Ukraine with as much as it takes for as long as it takes. Well, he wasn't just speaking for the Democratic Party. He wasn't just speaking for himself. He was speaking for the United States of America. You can't live in a situation where it's not tolerable to have a situation where presidential statements on major foreign policy issues aren't binding for the country itself, for the government itself. Like, the country is a different thing, right? People can disagree with whatever the president says, that's fine. But like, presidents make foreign policy, they make commitments. Those commitments matter, our alliances matter. And so just because it would be good for Biden, for Ukraine to win the war, and sort of bad for Trump or bad for Putin or bad for whoever, that is not a reason to be opposed to the aid, right? I mean, it is good for America if we are seen as an ally who keeps their word. But the zero-sum mindset in all this stuff, particularly when powered by dumbass partisan politics, can't see greater goods or knock-on effects or anything. It is just sort of have blinders on. If it's good for them, it's bad for us kind of approach. I think it's a way to think about this stuff that I just find sort of illuminating and helpful. And I want to write about it, but who knows where I'm going to go. I got to go to a meeting now. Well, I got to go talk to the pest control guy. But after that, I got to go to a meeting, and then I got to write a G-file. And then we record the Chris Wallace show on Fridays late in the day. And so I'm doing that. So I'll be on Saturday. And I don't know how many listeners here listen to the Australiana podcast put out by the Australian Spectator, or the Spectator of Australia, but I did a long podcast with them yesterday. It was fun. It was like, it's the weird week. Like, I did two speaking events where they asked me about my book, Suicide of the West, or where I was expected to talk about the topic of my first book, you know, liberal fascism. And then I did this podcast where, again, I talked about Suicide of the West. And anyway, it was a wide ranging thing and it was fun and interesting. And I'll tip people off when it's out. Also, thanks for all the feedback for the Nancy French episode. Man, did people love that episode. I mean, I love Nancy. I had fun talking to her. I did not expect it to have the reaction that it did out there. And I know everyone is, well, I wish everyone, but I know a lot of people are pulling for her because, you know, she's struggling with cancer and her whole family. But if you haven't listened to it, apparently it's just a delight for people. And I don't think it's because of me. You should probably go check it out. Also, knock on wood, because we haven't worked out all the logistics yet, but I think I'm going to be on one of my favorite podcasts, Ukraine the Latest, the Telegraph podcast, next week. I don't want to absolutely promise that because, again, news events can push things around and time zones and whatnot. But really looking forward to that. You know how much I like that podcast. And other than that, just to get back to where I sort of rambled on at the beginning, you know, I met a bunch of people this week for whom the Dispatch means a lot, or for whom the Remnant means a lot, or the G-File means a lot. And it makes me uncomfortable to hear the compliments in real time, but it also, it's really good to know. And so I'm grateful to everybody. You know, we're having conversations about, we have to turn on more revenue for the Dispatch if we're going to keep growing. And that means, you know, we've never said that we weren't going to do tasteful sponsorships. You know, we're never going to do programmatic kind of, well, there are definitions out there about programmatic that I don't want to get into. We're never going to do the crappy pop-up videos, toe fungus ads, any of that kind of stuff. But we're looking at different ways to do revenue. We're looking at different ways to do events with sponsored events and that kind of thing. And so if you're in a position where you could be helpful with that, where you might want to talk to our business people about any of that kind of stuff, reach out. My email is jonah@thedispatch.com. And I'll forward you to the appropriate parties. This is a business. We explicitly went into this not wanting to be a nonprofit. And I think we have demonstrated pretty well that our commitment to not screwing up the user experience or embracing a business model that creates incentives for dumb, hot take clickbait stuff. I think we're almost 5 years into this now. I think we've demonstrated we can be trusted on that, but we do, you know, we want to hire more people. We want to cover more things. And that means we got to grow, and to grow, we need more revenue. We don't need more revenue to survive. We're doing okay. Unlike a lot of other places, we're doing okay. But we want to do more. We want more subscribers. We want to cover more things. We want to have a bigger role out there. And that means we got to grow. And growth requires revenue. So if you have ideas about sponsorships, you know, either on the site or of specific newsletters or of events, or something outside the box that you can be helpful with, let me know and I'll let the right people know. And with that, thank you for, but the first and still most important thing you can do, if you're not in that kind of position, that's fine too. You know, I'm not beseeching. We have business people reaching out and making progress and all this stuff. But where everybody who listens to this can help is if they're not a subscriber to the Dispatch, they could subscribe. If they are a subscriber, thank you. Try to convince somebody else to subscribe. I have a hard time believing that most of our devoted readers don't know somebody enough like them that they too wouldn't want to subscribe and get something out of it. So think about that. And with that, thank you for listening and I'll talk to you next time.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.